Welcome to the I Hate Critics Movie Review Podcast. I am professional film critic and the person who has hated the most, Sean Kernahan. Sean Patrick. With me, of course, is Jeff.
I'm only hated by like a certain segment of the population. And they probably don't listen to the show anymore anyway. So.
Yeah, I think we've chased them off pretty well. Which is fine by me. visit us, of course, on our various social medias. We're at Critics Pod on Twitter. I won't call it the other thing.
I hate Twitter on my iPhone or on my iPad.
And so on and so forth. Where you search I Hate Critics, you'll find us. Because, you know, nobody else wants that name.
Although I have
critics. I mean, well, it's funny, you know, I am a professional film critic, a member of the Critics Choice Association, and I don't think they're aware that I'm part of a podcast that's called I Hate Critics.
I mean, it's the way that you talk about certain writers and critics and the way I look at other people, you know, including you when it comes to stuff. We don't hate critics. It's just, it's funny. So if people think we actually hate critics, then they're the problem. It's them.
Yeah, it's all about the attitude that a lot of Americans have about film critics.
Yeah. I have been telling people in person about the show, and they're like, oh my God, I love that name.
That's cool. Because they identify with
it. One of my friends who is involved in the film industry was like, oh, that's hilarious.
It was, well, not good. I'm happy to hear it. All right, we got a lot of movies to talk about. Only one that we both saw. We'll get to that a little later because it's the star of the show. So we'll just get out of the way with the. I'm going to start with Hundreds of Beavers. Have you heard about this movie?
Only from you, and I really wish I had a better job that I could see it in.
Hundreds of Beavers is a bizarre and completely hilarious film. It's directed by a guy named Mike Cheslick, who co-wrote the screenplay with his star, Ryland Brixen Cole Twos. And it's the story of a man who becomes a trapper in an Old West town that's one of those Winterset Western towns in the 1800s. He is beset upon by beavers, but they're not real beavers. They're people in beaver costumes who we are to see as actual beavers. And that it's a furry comedy, essentially. It's very, very funny. It's almost entirely wordless. It's like a Looney Tunes thing crossed with furries, crossed with The Revenant. And it's just a very funny idea that is just played incredibly, incredibly well. These are some very funny guys who have come up with some very funny gags. Trying to even figure out how to describe the plot of this movie. He needs to gather hundreds of beaver pelts in order to win the hearts of the trader's daughter. So he wants to win her heart. And he needs to capture a bunch of beavers to do it. But the beavers are smarter than he is, so that makes it difficult.
Would this make a good double feature with Zombievers?
Absolutely. Okay. I didn't love Zombievers, but yeah, totally. I get the connection at the very least. This and The Revenant, maybe back to back.
You know, I loved Zombievers as I was watching it, but I don't think I ever finished it.
Yeah, it's not a new movie that anybody finishes, I don't think. You just kind of, you get the gist of it and you walk away. This movie, though, this movie is so fun to watch. It is just, it's fun from the first moment to the last. They keep coming up. You think he's going to run out of bizarre ideas, and then he finds a new one to do, and he's building in like jokes in the background that are going to pay off later, and it's all in black and white and wordless, so it makes it sound like an art movie, but there's a lot of shit jokes in the movie, so it's like it's totally playing all of these elements against each other to create this comic friction that is just irresistible.
Nice.
Yeah, I'm a big fan. I think these guys are incredibly talented, and I would hate to see what money and success will do to them. I want them to continue with this. I want them to continue this aesthetic. I don't want them to get in the habit of having money in the future.
Well, yeah.
Which is a sentiment. I know that I'm taking that probably from Bob. Well, Mom always says that about the best independent filmmakers. They don't need the money.
Yeah, I mean, when you start off with no money and you're given money, you go from Evil Dead to Evil Dead 2. Or else you go from, I name a bad one. you know what I mean? It's like, it just depends on who you are and what you do with it.
Yeah. Like a good director can make the proper adjustments and try and still maybe keep the originality and the heart that made them who they are. And hopefully that's the case with these two guys, is that they can keep the spirit of this alive and build upon it, as opposed to moving into more mainstream style filmmaking. Because I don't think mainstream is what these guys are not capable of it. They may be capable of it, but it's not necessarily what they need to do. They need to do this, but better. Yeah. Even better, even more ambitious, even more weird.
I like that.
Yeah, make everything weirder. That's the really
that's my life's mantra.
As somebody who has to see all the movies, I'd like them all to have at least a little bit of weird to them. It makes things better.
Agreed.
Unfortunately, I say that, and then we go into talking about Arcadian, which is an incredibly, it's a normcore, post-apocalypse movie, but it's a good one. It takes all the things you know about an apocalypse movie and just does them really, really well, and has Nicolas Cage. The story here is that Nicolas Cage is a guy who's witnessing the fall of humanity. He retreats into the forest. He happens to have two babies. Whether or not they're his babies, we don't know. Is he just rescued two babies? We don't know. We never see the mother. We don't know their backstory. The boys do kind of look like that. They're clearly not twins, and yet they seem to be either the same age or very close to the same age. So it's interesting. It says a lot about him, though, that he, as just a single individual, would rescue two babies and keep them safe from whatever is happening that's ending the rest of humanity. They have managed to stay alive into the baby's becoming teenagers, and they both of them seem to have different tracks of what they want to do in terms of building a future. With one child wants to study the monsters that have been attacking and killing people, and of course are now spreading out into their area, into the woods, and the other one wants to meet girls and have sex, and he's got a girl who's at another farm that's not far away from theirs that he can go see on occasion, and that's kind of both of their tracks will define what most of the story is. And Nicolas Cage's character is sort of there to oversee them, and then he'll get disappeared for a little bit from the plot, but he's got some big moments near the end that really work. And he gets to do his Nicolas Cage thing just a little bit at the end, and it's just the perfect amount of his Nicolas Cage thing that he does. And I really like that. I also like these monsters. They did make the monsters weird. The monsters are strange looking. They've got kind of nebulous powers, but the way they move is very unique. You've not likely seen monsters that move like this. Maybe they might be quite similar to the A Quiet Place monsters, but not so close that you're going, okay, those are the same kind of, it's too much to the same, it's nothing like that. They also are not, they're not powered by sound. They have a problem with the sun, so they're kind of vampiric, I guess, but that's pretty much where any kind of similarities in their monsters begin and end right there.
So they come at night.
They do start coming. Yeah, they do come at night. That's true. There is certainly, I guess, a similarity to that film. But there's a lot of similarities. But the thing about it is that this movie is very well directed. It's got a good pace, a terrific cast. The young teenagers are terrific. Jaden Martell and Maxwell Jenkins deliver terrific performances here as two very different teenagers with two very different aims who are going to come together eventually to try and save their land from these monsters. The monsters are learning and evolving and are becoming better at attacking and adjusting to the Earth as their planet. And these guys have to figure out how to stop that. Fun movie. And like I said, it just does what you know of post-apocalypse movies and just does it a little bit better.
Good, good. I look forward to seeing it if I ever get to work a daytime shift.
Strange releases for both this one and another one we'll talk about later. They're not getting daytime shows.
Yep, unfortunately.
Now, you saw a movie that I didn't get a chance to see. Tell us about this one.
I got to see Problemista on its last night in town. Julio Torres plays Alejandro, he's an aspiring toy designer, and he moved here from El Salvador to try to get a job at Hasbro, which as a toy collector was one of my little niggles with this because Hasbro is not in New York City. Anyway, but he's got all these weird ideas for toys that, you know, a little outside of the mainstream, but could be fun. Mm-hmm. And he is about to lose his sponsorship to stay in the United States because he gets fired from his day job that has sponsored him for as long as he's been in the States. He works at a company that freezes people so that they can come back after whatever is ailing them is cured in the future. Mm-hmm. And RZA plays Bobby, who was an artist who had terminal cancer, so he decided to get frozen. And his partner, Tilda Swinton, as Elizabeth, she is the one who, has made sure that he stays there. And he accidentally, we'll say, unplugs the life support freezer, which doesn't result in him thawing out or anything bad. It's just he was negligent, so he loses his job. And then through a little run-in with Elizabeth, he is trying to get her to sponsor him. And he's resourceful and comes up with a lot of ideas to help her get a show for Bobby so that they can continue to pay for him to be kept frozen. If he does this, she will then sponsor him to stay in the United States. Tilda Swinton she's almost like Meryl Streep in The Devil Wears Prada, but she's got that kind of imperiousness about her, but she's also like, she plays this with an undercurrent of sadness and brokenness that I love her anyway, but this was to me one of her very, very, very best performances that I've ever seen. She's just incredible. The way she plays this broken, hurting person who also breaks and hurts other people. She screams at service people and she screams at Alejandro. She's playing him off against another potential assistant, Bingham, played by James Scully. And I remember the trailer for this, and I thought that there was some sort of love subplot, but they have cut this out of the movie, and I don't know why. But Alejandro's mother, Dolores, I think her name is, she's his support and sends him $40 here and there. You know, he needs thousands of dollars to stay in the country. And just the encouragement that she gives him is just super sweet. And Julio Torres, he embodies this anxious character so well that you just get that. You don't have to listen to him even for the first part. He has this little, like his walk is a little bit of a run, like a little jog. And it just conveys the anxiety that he's feeling so well. It's really interesting and kind of a surrealist comedy. And when I said I don't gravitate towards comedies, I don't gravitate towards, you know, The Hangover and stuff like that. This is the kind of comedy that I want to see where people are a little like like you said earlier, weird, and it's a little surreal, not necessarily, mm-hmm. you know, realism. But yeah, it's
an A24 comedy. Maybe that's what it is.
Yeah. I mean, there are certain things that are realistic to living in New York, mm-hmm. but played with a heightened sense that kind of add to the surrealism. There is a really, I don't want to necessarily spoil anything, but there is there's a sequence that is how Alejandro deals with Elizabeth, and she's some sort of weird red-eyed demon on his back.
Mm-hmm.
And just, have you ever been in a position where you know that you didn't do the work or you don't know how to do something, but you just kind of lie your way into job or, how I got on this show. but he, you know, he does that about this one situation that they're doing that she has a specific demand, and he's like, oh yeah, absolutely, I totally know it. And then that kind of drives the underlying plot for about a half an hour. And I related to that so well, because Microsoft Teams is the devil. Just fantastic performances. Julio Torres wrote and directed this, and I couldn't tell you if he's like this in real life, because he acts it so well that the angst and anxiety is just, it kind of just oozes off the screen. And he has this face that he always looks like he's a little confused and a little scared, but then he manages to pull off all the stuff in the end. And the end of the movie is not what you expect.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the way it just is executed is just phenomenal. I hope everybody gets to see this, especially for Tilda Swinton. I mean, she just looks like a wreck. Her brown roots are showing with her pink hair, and her makeup is always a little sketchy and runny, and she just looks terrible. But you see women like that all the time in New York who are still in LA, still kind of have that Baby Jane about them, where they're past their ability to make it,
mm-hmm.
but somehow they've convinced themselves that they aren't, and that they're going to make it. So
it sounds like a perfectly Tilda Swinton kind of character.
Oh, I mean, you know how I always am about like actresses and how they should be nominated. I would love to see her nominated. She won't. It's not a big enough movie. And she does, you know, she does, no matter what she's doing, she always kind of embodies that little weirdness.
She is the purity of acting. I mean, you mm-hmm. you can't see her act, and you also can't see her as Tilda Swinton. Tilda Swinton doesn't exist, as it would seem. She can do anything. She could play man, woman, alien, animal. Mm-hmm. She could play it all and make it seem like it's real in front of you, and effortlessly so. It doesn't. That's the problem that she has. Is that it never looks like she's doing the most work.
Yeah. Well, and even in this movie, when she's screaming at waiters, she's just got this underlying vulnerability that, you know, if you saw a woman like this, you just would call her a Karen and, you know, videotape her doing this. But she kind of transcends that with this vulnerability underneath all of that. It's not, you know, she thinks she's better than everybody else, but she knows deep down that she's not. And she, I, there's just something about it that like, I lost her a lot. I just saw Elizabeth and the vulnerability and the fact that, you know, what's coming, you know, she's going to freak out, but you're kind of wondering, okay, how is she going to redeem it? Is she going to redeem it? So Yeah, just that an all very just cool. Like it's in my top 10 so far this year.
Oh, very cool. All right. Well, I'll definitely see it by the end of the year, that's for sure.
Yeah.
All right. The movie people came here to hear us talk about, it was, of course, Sting. No, I'm kidding. I'm kidding. It's another A24 movie, actually. Civil War. Directed by Alex Garland and starring Kirsten Dunst, Wagner Moura, Kaylee Spaney, and Stephen McKinley Henderson. It's set in a dystopian future America where the country is badly divided to the point where of a civil war. The forces of California and Texas and perhaps the Florida faction are coming together to try and take down the president, played by Nick Offerman, who is, I guess we don't know. You can't really assume that this is a Trump-like character. Mm-hmm. I guess you can kind of infer that, but the movie definitely doesn't infer either way. And that's part of the problem that a lot of people have with this movie, Jeff, is that it doesn't take a stand. It's simply taking the perspective of these photojournalists and trying to remain as indifferent to what's caused this and it really leaves you kind of going, is the point of the movie that war is bad? Because yeah, war is bad. We know. Like shooting at each other is not going to help us. It's not going to do us any good. And it's not going to help anyone. That's something we kind of already know. And I hate to reduce it to that because I think Alex Garland is a fucking genius. I mean, the man has created just incredible movie after incredible movie. I stand by the fact that Men is one of the best movies of the year that came out. I think on top of that, you know, his work on Annihilation is insanely incredible. Ex Machina. I think all three of those movies have ended up in my top 10 for the year they came out. This is not going to be in my top 10, but it is certainly a movie I'm going to be thinking about for quite some time because it is a very thoughtful movie and it's an incredibly well-made movie. It's a great looking film. The cinematography by Rob Hardy is exceptional. Kirsten Dunst's performance is one of the best of her career. I never want to see the movie again, and I'm not sure what the movie intended to be.
I definitely want to see this movie again just to see some of the performances and to see if I'm wrong about a couple problems that I had with it. I'm not one of the people who had a problem with the fact that you're not quite sure what the politics of the movie are. At first I was like, okay, what happened? You know, what drove us to a civil war? Mm-hmm. By the end of the movie, that's not what I was thinking about. I kind of had figured, and people said, oh, that California and Texas would never come together. And Alex Garland, he had a quote. Somebody said, is it just to obfuscate the politics of the movie? And he said, are you saying extremist politics would always remain more important than a president of this sort? That sounds crazy to me. And I feel like in that way, the movie is kind of hopeful about the country in that, and I honestly thought the movie was going to be, set in the future about what's happening now and how it, how it affected us as a country. And in a way it is, but in a way it's just, it's its own universe. And that by the end of the movie, I was like, we just know that Nick Offerman as a president is, he's power hungry and he has walled himself off literally from the rest of the country. He is the kind of person who he reminded me a little bit of the Mandarin in Iron Man 3. Mm-hmm. That kind of figurehead that's really just a weak person behind him, which I think a lot of figurehead people like Trump or Bolsonaro or any of these leaders, the semi-fascistic leaders, Viktor Orban, I think they're really actually weak. But they want to play the strong man because that's what gets them votes and money and power. And I kind of got that impression from him. Not that he was playing Trump, but that he had made decisions that so many people were, up in arms about and not.
They mentioned something about him being in his third term, as if he might have suspended an election to continue on as president.
Mm-hmm. Which is a very real concern that we have nowadays, because, you know, obviously Joe Biden has said he's never going to leave office. I'm just kidding. but, you know, I mean, that's something that we as a country are having to deal with on a fairly regular basis. You know, if I hear every day, if Trump comes to power again, he will never leave, and he'll, you know, we'll have a monarchy because he'll install Don Jr. or Ivanka. Although, I don't know, I wouldn't, if I was him, I wouldn't do Ivanka because she has a couple billion dollars and wouldn't even pay his legal fees. But, you know, I mean, I hear that every day, and I'm like, that, something like that could lead to the Civil War movie that we were at. You know, that could be Barron Trump for all we know. And I thought that defeated kind of flat tone that Kirsten Dunst had throughout the entire movie was just like a lot of people are now, that just they're, oh, I don't want to do politics anymore because it's just everything is so much. And I completely get that. I've unfollowed a lot of stuff recently just to see if it would improve my mood. It didn't. I'm just old and but I get that, you know, that she's just kind of tired. And you know, she's there because that's all she knows, is how to do this, how to be a war photographer. And I don't think she feels one way or the other about it, even though that, you know, their goal is to get a picture of the president surrendering and getting, and Wagner Mora's character, Joel, he wants to get a quote, you know, before the president is led away or killed or whatever they're going to do to deal with him. So I think that her kind of apathy and apathy towards Jesse, played by Kaylee Spaney, who I did not recognize for the life of me, because I think I've only seen her in Priscilla. But, you know, that her kind of apathy and like, oh, Jesus, what are we doing to this poor child, kind of semi-protectiveness. That's how I think a lot of people feel about politics in general today. So.
Yeah, there's almost the thing like, you're stop forcing me to try to care, kid.
Yeah, yeah.
And that type of resignation that she has is part of that performance, and it's an interesting part of that performance. I heard a critic trying to argue that what happens to Kirsten Dunst late in the movie isn't motivated enough. And I don't necessarily agree with that. I think the whole point of her character is kind of being dragged into giving a damn again until she finally does give a damn, and then what happens. And that's, you know, it's a form of the redemptive arc, you know, of somebody who's not, she's not a villain character by any means, but she is a character who has stopped feeling, stopped caring a little bit, and is just resigned to, let's just get this thing done, and, you know, we'll deal with it later. The whole arc is her being won around to kind of giving a damn about something, and it turns out to be this young photographer who, yes, in a classic sort of screenwriting way, is the mirror image of her as a younger person. She can see herself in her, and that's a very screenwritery, tropey thing to write, but at the same time, it does play out well. It does work. They are a good mirror for each other. I can accept that. And I do feel it that her change of attitude was motivated in part by what happens with Stephen McKinley Harrison's character.
Yeah.
But also, it's about her, the whole arc of her thing is coming around to care about something. This, maybe it's not either side of the cause, which nobody really knows to what the cause really is in many ways. It's about coming around to care about a person again. And that's the character arc. And I buy that. I found the movie to be somewhat miserable in a way, in that way that so much dystopian fiction is constantly miserable about the future of humanity.
Yeah.
I did like, you know, the little stories that they told about, you know, both Kirsten Dunst and Kaylee Spaney's families live in places where they don't have to care. And yeah. It's like, I love those people. That's where I'd be.
I honestly wish I could be that way. I'm far too in the weeds, you know, politically as it is now. Mm-hmm. I wish I could, you know, I wish I didn't have to care.
I tell the story often anytime this topic comes up, but John Mulaney's bit about Trump being the horse in the hospital is just one of the greatest political metaphors I've ever heard, because prior to him, you could be like him and not care about what was happening. You know, you have a semi-competent person who's in charge, kind of doing their job and doing it to the best of their abilities. I don't need to care about anything. Now you've got a horse running loose in a hospital who's going to daily just kind of frighten you into remembering that he's there. And it's like, oh God, I got to give a fuck now.
Yeah, exactly. I want to, if you don't want spoilers for this, skip ahead. Like just go 3.5-4 minutes. Cause I have to spoil something in order to talk about one of my big issues with the movie. Mm-hmm. Okay, so skip ahead. You're skipped ahead. Kirsten Dunst at the beginning of the movie says, you know, she says, if, you know, basically, if you were being shot, I would be there to take the photo. You know, I would be there. And when it ends up that Kirsten Dunst has kind of checked out after Sammy, Stephen McKinley Henderson, after he dies. Mm-hmm. And she checks out for, you know, the kind of the next 10 minutes. I felt like they might have been missing a little snippet of a scene, because she goes from washing all the blood off to, as they're running through the streets of Washington, D.C., suddenly she's just almost catatonic and can't move. And I felt like there could have been a little, you know, where she said, I can't do it anymore. I just can't. And, you know. And Joel and Jesse would be like, no, you have to, you know, you're Lee, you're fucking Lee or whatever. I felt at that moment, I felt her fate was literally written across the screen. You know, this is either the last moments of her life. And I really thought, after she told Jesse that, yes, I will absolutely take the photos of your, you know, of you being shot and killed, because that's the news, I really thought that should have happened, that it should have been Jesse who died, and that would have really hit the emotional core for me more so for her, for Lee, than just being killed, because she finally had something she cared about. And as much as I don't want to watch Kirsten Dunst cry, because I love her, I wanted that emotional, you know, that was the emotional toll that got her to the president and, you know, to do this for Jesse. So
that's what I was talking about, is the arc that people are complaining about is that she has that, you know, sort of breakdown once they get to Washington, D.C. And like I said, I think she was watching Kaylee Spaney's character become her. And starting to feel, you know, fear and care for her, and that's what was kind of pushing her around. Not so much as the Sammy thing also was hitting her too, all at once, and all of this, you know, collision and death happening around her. Even though she's been through it before, she's got things that she gives a damn about now. And I felt that was earned. I felt those moments actually were relatively well earned for her to have that. Have that moment, and then of course for her fate to be sealed soon after that was, I thought that was the full completion of that arc. Mm. That again doesn't, you know, mitigate the problems that I have with the movie being utterly fucking miserable to sit through, because it is a miserable, angry movie, and I don't know how to recommend this movie. It's incredibly well made. It's a work of art. Garland is an incredible director. Who do I recommend this to? Who do I say, yes, this is definitely something you want to sit through? It reminded me of talking about the movie the 9/11 recreation movie that Paul Greengrass directed, Flight 93.
Yeah.
I saw that movie before it came out. I saw it at a critic screening, and we're all just kind of floored by this, you know, picture perfect recreation of what was happening in the flight control on the day that 9/11 happened. And then I go to the theater that day to see something else, and I'm watching people line up with popcorn and pop to watch a perfect recreation of September 11th, 4 years later. And it's just the dissonance in my head just can't make any sense of how you eat popcorn and watch a perfect recreation of September 11th happen in front of you. And that's the same kind of feeling I have thinking about Civil War. How do I sell? How do I sit there and tell you to grab your popcorn and pop and go watch the end of America, guys? as it would probably happen.
Well, I for one don't think we'll even get to this part.
I hope not. I mean, because really the other side has all the guns. I think we're fucked in that case.
No, I just meant we're gonna get nuked way before this we get to the Civil War portion. Yeah. Also, some of the discourse around it has changed from, you know, this movie doesn't have enough politics in it, to Jesse Plemons is the embodiment of fascism in America, which, yeah. and the, oh my God, Wagner Moura is who Pedro Pascal, everybody thinks Pedro Pascal looks like. And I'm like, which Wagner Moura, the one from here or the one from Narcos where he played Pablo Escobar and was all fat and shit? And they were like, oh, that's not him. And I'm like, girl, look it up.
Oh, yeah, I saw a horrible meme. Somebody said the Pedro Pascal you have at home.
Yeah.
Which is just like, no, that's not, no. You're being, that's just kind of, it's kind of vaguely racist, honestly.
Yeah. I enjoy this movie. I think if you're into politics, if you're, I hate to say it this way because it sounds so elitism, but if you're smart enough to just go in and figure it all out for yourself, as opposed to being spoon-fed which side is the good side and which side is the bad side, and, you know, I think this movie is going to reflect your politics. The scene with Jesse Plemons where he's like, what kind of American are you? Mm-hmm. Man, does that, like, that was triggering in so many ways.
But I think the thesis statement scene though is actually the one where they're arriving at a place and they see they've got a gunman on the ground who is firing at a house, mm-hmm. at a house that is has a sniper inside. And Wagner Moura is continuously asking these two guys, one's a spotter, one's a shooter, which side are you on? Are you from the Texas Florida Texas California Alliance? Are you with the Western Front or with the White House? What are you? And they're like, he's shooting at us, and we're shooting at him.
Yeah,
and we're trying to stop him from shooting at us. And that, to me, I think is the thesis statement of the movie: is that people are shooting at each other, and you know, want that if you shoot at me, I shoot back. Is the real thing that Garland is getting at is that ideology goes out the window when both sides have guns.
Yep. By the way, that gunman who said that was Jin Ha from the show Devs. Have you ever seen that?
No, I haven't.
It's really good. It's got it. It has everybody from the cast. Nick Offerman's in it. Jin Ha's in it. Kaylee Spaney's in it. Stephen McKinley Henderson. You know, so many of the people from Civil War. It was directed and created by Alex Garland. So, definitely well worth seeing. But yeah, that scene is like, that's what we will be reduced to if we do make it another couple generations into a Civil War like this. You know, I can find middle ground with just about anybody. I do laugh at people who think that somebody is, you know, the second coming and they don't think they're in a cult. which I wish we could just get to the part of the cult where they go to Guyana and start mixing up the flavor aid, but that's just me being an intolerant lefty. But
I have one thing where I just, I will not try and understand your hatreds. If you hate gay people, if you hate black people, there, that's a divide that we're not going to cross. Like, I'm never going to reach a place where I can sit in a room with you and have a pleasant conversation. That's just not going to happen because those are people who are threatening my friends and my family. And that to me, there's no common ground there. And the way that people have tried to pull that into the conversation of, well, why can't we have a simple disagreement? No, we're not going to disagree over whether or not my cousin gets to live or not. Like, we're not going to compromise on that.
Well, that's the James Baldwin quote. We can disagree and still love each other unless your disagreement is rooted in my oppression and denial of my humanity and right to exist.
Yeah, that's the perfectly succinct way to put that.
Yeah, I mean, that's how I look at it. I've worked with some people over the last few years since I moved back here to Iowa that would literally be the guys, you know, the soldiers or whatever, standing there asking, "What kind of an American are you?" And I'm, you know, like, I'm an American, so.
You can't reason with the Jesse Plemons character. You can't sit in a room with that character and have a pleasant conversation. Mm-hmm. Like, that's just not, there's no common ground there. We both agree that the tax policy is wrong. This doesn't matter. He wants to kill people. He wants people I care about to not exist. That's not something we can have a conversation about.
Well, and if either one of the characters that he kills, Nelson Lee played one of them and Evan Lai, the other, if either one of them had said, you know, oh, I'm from Florida or wherever Wagner Moura said he was from, he would have still killed him because they're not white.
Yeah.
Yeah. He wouldn't, I don't believe you. Well, you know, show me your ID, you know, and they could, whatever. It just, he would have. He was that guy who you cannot be reasoned with. You know, you cannot look different than he does or act different or speak different. And I think that's part of the divide in this movie is, you know, who's the real American? What makes somebody a real American? What makes somebody, you know, on the right side?
Mm-hmm.
So,
all right, so I think we both appreciate Civil War. You more than me, you recommend it. I don't know how to recommend this experience to anybody other than to say if you like a great work of art, it is a great work of art. It's an incredibly well-directed film. It's just not one that I ever want to experience again.
Fair enough.
All right, let's talk about giant spiders. Or in the case, at least that's the case in Sting, not so much in the other movie, but Sting is about an alien spider, actually. It's an alien spider crashes through the window of a Brooklyn apartment building and begins to build itself up. It's taken in by a young girl who happens to be a big fan of spiders. She's a comic book artist, and she takes inspiration from a relatively large spider that she finds that she calls Sting. This is Lila Brown, the star. And she puts Sting in a jar and begins feeding him other bugs, and he gets bigger, and the bigger he gets, the more hungry he gets. And eventually he'll move on to human victims, and eventually he'll turn on his owner at a certain point. And just everything that the big giant spider movie promises, the spider movie gore, webs, grossness. If you have a problem with spiders, you're going to have a problem with this movie because the spider is big and gross and nasty and mean and kills people. And it's fun to watch. I had a good time with this movie. This movie's got a great dark sense of humor to it. It's got a good pace. Lila Brown is a wonderful young actress, and she's joined by Ryan Corr, who plays her stepdad. They have a lovely little stepdad-stepdaughter dynamic going on. At once, he's, you know, he works with her on her comic book, but at the same time, he's also trying to establish himself as a father figure. That doesn't get too much attention because this is still a giant spider horror movie, but it gets enough attention to humanize both of these characters to where you really care about them and want them to survive the giant alien spider that's trying to kill them. I really enjoyed this movie a lot. I recommend it highly, especially to horror film fans, to monster movie fans. This is a terrific piece of B-movie pulp. It's phenomenal.
Oh, now I'm really mad.
I know. You should really see this when you get a chance. It's fun. It's a fun movie. It's not a great movie. It's not a particularly outstanding, well-made movie. It's just a really good monster movie. It is what it is. It knows what it is, and it sets out to accomplish being a giant alien spider movie.
Good. So it's not Kingdom of the Spiders.
Whereas Kingdom of the Spiders is our classic this week, starring William Shatner. I wanted to just talk about spider movies, you know? I wanted to talk about it, and I've already done, for me, I've done Arachnophobia. It's good enough. I don't need to ever see Arachnophobia again. I wrote it up for the book. I talked about it last year for a while, and that one is probably, is that the most well-known spider-based horror movie?
Probably.
Are there many others that you can think of?
No, not off the top of my head.
our horror film expert.
I honestly like that kind of like the nature turning on, you know, human beings movies have never been kind of my favorite horror movies.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there are some of them like Night of the Lepus, which is about giant killer rabbits. you know, stuff like that, and them I've seen, but they've never really done it for me. Let's just put it that way.
Did you like Arachnophobia?
Yeah, I saw it when it came out. I saw it in theater and I enjoyed it. It was more of a comedy to me, like a comedy for people who want to be scared because they hate spiders. But yeah.
The best spider movie of all time is one that doesn't advertise itself as a spider movie, and that's Enemy with Jake Gyllenhaal, but I don't want to spoil anything.
I've never seen that.
just see it. It's incredible. then, you know, obviously Arachnophobia we just mentioned. There just aren't many. I think there was a movie called Them or They that was back in the 1940s that's a giant spider movie. That got some attention and some people liked.
Also, that movie Big Ass Spider.
I'm just looking at the poster for that one. A spider crawling up the side of a building is pretty cool.
Yeah, I totally forgot about that until just a second.
But I don't know. I just wanted something that wasn't Arachnophobia, so I just grabbed the first funny looking spider movie that I could find, and we found Kingdom of the Spider from 1977. Where William Shatner plays a character named Rack Hansen. Rack Hansen. You know, he's from Verde Valley, Arizona. He gets an urgent call from a farmer about a sick calf, and it turns out that...
Just so everybody knows, he is not his brother. Not his brother Johnny, and he never will be.
No, he's never been his brother Johnny ever.
How many times did he say that?
A few too many. He discovers that the calf was bit by a spider. He's joined eventually in this quest by Linda. Is it Linda? Is that Natasha Ryan's character?
I think so.
Natasha Ryan's character. Who joins him, and she's also a scientist. They're looking into
what Diane.
Her
name was Diane.
Diane, excuse me. Diane, they're looking Ashley. Into what caused this spider. What are causing these spiders to become so aggressive? And eventually, they're just spiders everywhere. Just spider. To the point that the spiders are just causing mass chaos. And you got to give credit to that final image, Jeff. The last image of the movie. Yeah. At the very least, as dumb as this movie is, an entire city covered in spider web is a pretty cool visual.
And Leonard Maltin loved it, so
clearly. He did. Huh.
Yeah. A well-crafted thriller is what he called it.
I would not go remotely that far.
Well, this is only the second movie that Leonard Maltin never saw, so clearly.
So he was 12. If you saw this when you were 12, yeah, you would think this was pretty incredible.
He saw it at 11 and wrote his review at 12, so.
That would make perfect sense. Yeah, I mean, it's hilarious to watch Shatner be Shatner and do his Shatner thing. He's very masculine. He sees himself as the ultimate manly man. He condescends to the woman who's helping him and everyone always around him. And yeah, he's the one, of course, who figures out that the spiders are dangerous. But of course, he also is somehow impervious to spiders because he gets bit multiple times. Whereas some people get bit, they're just dead immediately.
He gets bit
hundreds of times by hundreds of spiders and then gets back up and is there at the end of the movie.
Right in the face in the last 5 minutes, and you're sure he's going to die. And then he springs up into action to look out the window and see that everything is covered in spider webs.
Everything's covered in spider webs. Oh my God. That's amazing. And then the movie just ends. It just ends. It's so good. That's a great way to end a movie. Just these characters have no hope. Everyone's going to die. Goodbye, everybody.
Yeah, exactly. I think like they were going for that twist, you know, that like everybody always gets saved in the end of everything. Let's do the opposite. And boy.
Are you familiar with the director, John Bud Cardos?
No, not until I saw this movie. So
he's got a quite the filmography. His first film was released in 1970 called Soul Soldier. Yeah, you can guess from the title that what that might be. He directed 1979's The Dark with Richard Jekyll and Keenan Wynn. He directed The Day Time Ended, which sounds like an amazing film. 1984's Mutant, which entered theaters as Night Shadows.
Yeah, okay.
1988's Outlaw of Gore, which, my God, we've got to see this fucking movie. Have you ever heard of Outlaw of Gore?
I have not.
This looks pretty goddamn amazing. It's also known as Gore 2.
Oh, Lord.
Look up the post right now, because if that can't be Jack Palance, he's wearing just this giant feather hat. It is Jack Palance. Oh my God.
Well, I'm on it. I just opened Jack up his Palance IMDb as page. Genos. And it looks like he was making, towards the end of his life, he was making quite a name for himself as a driver. On Memento and Secretary. Oh, wow. And yeah.
That's amazing.
Now I'm looking up Gore.
Yeah, Satan, wow. Sadist.
Okay. I have seen Satan Sadists years and years ago.
Oh, nice.
I don't remember anything about it.
I think we need to do a side podcast that is just this guy's filmography, because it's incredible.
I mean, if you can get all the movies, I'm more than happy to do it.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Soul, we start with Soul Soldier in 1970, and we go through Active Piracy in 1990, which has got Gary Busey. I mean, this guy and Gary Busey, that's got to be great.
He also was a driver on Blue Lagoon, The Awakening. Oh, yeah. He was in the transportation department for a lot of well-known movies, actually.
Hmm.
He was the bomb driver in Phantoms.
In Phantoms with Ben Affleck?
He was one of the drivers, yeah.
What the... Wow. So he went from directing this movie to driving on...
I mean, you have seen this movie.
Yeah. What an odd and unusual and brilliant career trajectory.
Yeah, Lord.
I love that for him.
Oh, God. That poster for Gore. Outlaw of Gore.
It is. It's something, isn't it?
Jack right, Palance was just a few years away from doing one-arm push-ups on the Oscars.
Yeah, no kidding. And he was in Outlaw of Gore. Gore
and
too.
some of these pictures look like they're taken from the set of Dark Shadows.
If we get 2 new Patreon subscribers, we will do the entire filmography of Bud Cardos. How about that? Bud Cardos' entire filmography.
As a director.
Only as a director. We will do his filmography as a director if we get 2 new patrons. All right.
Sounds good to me.
All right. Let's do some flick chart very quickly here. Wizard of Oz or Shooter?
Wizard of Oz.
Wizard of Oz, easily, no question. Love the Wizard of Oz. Man on Fire or The Crush? Good fucking Christ. You picked Jeff because I hate both these movies. Yeah, okay,
Man on Fire because it has Dakota in it.
Man on Fire because it isn't about, because it's not necessarily, it's only tangentially about child rape.
Just a little bit.
Ooh, here's a good one. There's two very different, very good movies here. Sicario or Dazed and Confused?
Oh. I actually like both of those. I'm going to pick Dazed and Confused.
Yeah, I'll go there too. But Sicario's really good.
Yeah. But it doesn't have Parker Posey in it.
Eric! Papillon with Charlie Hunnam or The Terminal with Tom Hanks? Good fucking Christ. What are you trying to do to me here, Flick Chart?
Fishing with Gandhi?
I think both these movies are just, they're miserably long and not very good. Tom Hanks is a really nice guy. I'm picking The Terminal.
Yeah, okay.
Even though I think that movie's bad. Fried Green Tomatoes or Star Wars Episode 2 Attack of the Clones?
Episode 2 Attack of the Clones is my least favorite Star Wars movie. So I'm going to pick Fried Green Tomatoes.
Interesting. I'll go there as well.
I just saw it recently for the first time, so I've never seen it.
It's quite an emotional film.
Yes.
Are you going to get your Phantom Menace popcorn tin?
If I have any money whatsoever, my hours got cut in half, so I can barely afford to go to the movies, much less a popcorn tin. So
yeah, 25th anniversary of the Phantom Menace this year.
Yep, I'm gonna try to. I'm using my monthly free ticket to see it. So
yeah, well,
although my birthday is in less than 2 weeks,
we'll have to see Phantom Menace back as a classic, perhaps.
Okay.
Let's see. Fantastic Beasts or Rocky 3?
Rocky 3. Fuck.
By a lot. Ugh.
I hate Fantastic Beasts in every single way. Everything about it is unappealing. Mm-hmm. Eddie Redmayne looks like if Julianne Moore had a gender reassignment surgery when she was 20. J.K. Rowling, fuck her. Fuck the fact that they fire one of the people but don't fire the other from the same studio for doing pretty much the same thing to each other.
How cursed is that franchise to have both Johnny Depp and Ezra Miller and J.K. Rowling? Like, it's the most cursed franchise in the world.
Well, and honestly, yes, Johnny Depp probably abused the shit out of Amber Heard, but Amber Heard also did all the same shitty things to him. Why did he get fired and she didn't? I don't know.
She's getting it pretty hard right now, I would say.
Well,
so.
Yeah, but I'm just like, she wasn't cut out of Aquaman, too.
They would have if they could have.
Yeah.
They could have got away with it. They would have. They sacrificed much of that movie's plot to make sure she wasn't there as much as she needed to be.
They should have just recast her, honestly.
Yeah.
They should have recast her with Mads Mikkelsen.
Alien or Pretty in Pink?
Alien.
Pretty in Pink.
Really?
Oh, yeah. I'm not a big fan of the Aliens franchise. I don't find it that appealing.
I loved Pretty in Pink when I saw it when I was 13.
Mm-hmm.
But now I just see that dress and it turns the whole movie on its head for me.
Aliens wins, unfortunately, but yeah, I bought into the whole Ripley hype, and then we did a big watch along with Josh. It's one of Josh's mm-hmm. favorites of all time, and we're watching it. And both Bob and I are just kind of having this moment of like, this is not. She's not actually that impressive of a character. A lot of shit is just sort of happening and she's reacting to it. She doesn't exactly drive the plot as this badass action hero. She kind of spends the first movie hiding and the next movie reacting.
Well, in her defense,
mm-hmm.
in the first one, she's the only one who was following protocol.
Yeah.
And what did there was that meme that went around for a while. My wife and I watched Alien and she said, "Yep, once again they don't listen to the smart woman and everybody dies."
Mhm. So There's that. I think what mainly that both Bob and I are criticizing is the perception that people created around Ripley as this, ultimate badass female, and I think that does a disservice to who she is as a character. To treat her like she's Rambo. Oh, she's not Rambo.
Oh, yeah, 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 absolutely. I don't see her as a Rambo character. I see her as a mother, because that's what mother against mother in actually both movies, because she was a mother. You didn't know that about her until the second movie, but she was a mother and she was fighting other onboard AI. And then in the second one, she was a mother who had lost her daughter and then gained another one fighting another mother who is defending her hive. So I never saw her as Rambo. I just saw her as mm-hmm. a pissed off mom.
But the pop culture impression of her is wrong.
I know what you're saying. I'm just bringing
it. All right. We're going to end on this one. This is the most controversial decision you'll ever make in your life, Jeff. Look Who's Talking Now or Flushed Away.
Does Flushed Away have Kirstie Alley in it?
No.
Then it's Flushed Away.
I wish we could flush Look Who's Talking franchise. All right, Jeff, thank you.
Have a good one.